So the question was whether they would last 4 or 6 months. So you're saying a year or two, that covers well and truly 4 or 6 months.
Yeah. Look, everything in biodynamics, you'll find it fits a cycle. In other words, if you harvest, so to speak, you collect the weed when it's in full growth and flower, etc., and then make your tea, you then really want to be putting it out before that plant would germinate the next time. So these things fit into your annual cycle. So you harvest it, so to speak, at harvest time, and you put the weed tea out with the preparations in the autumn.
When the weed that you're aiming at is when it's dormant, before it has it regenerates.
And as I said, the thing to do is to actually think it through into your annual cycle, so these things just become part of your annual cycle, like shearing or harvesting or whatever it is.
And what about couch grass, Hamish? Does that require any special treatment or?
John, couch grass,
couch, there's two things about couch. It is, it probably helps to propagate better than any other plant all of the fungi that we need in the soil. Having said that, you'll find with couch, once you get the 500 or soil activator onto the land where it is, it becomes more attractive to cattle, and simply the cattle grazing it more heavily and intensely, you will find that you don't have to work it out or spend any money getting rid of it. The cattle will flog it down and it loses its pioneering capability as the quality of it improves.
John, that's a very good question for grazing people. So keep talking about that, but then I want you to look at the fact that George doesn't have animals on his place. He's just cropping only.
Right, well, in most cases, if he gets his pH up to about 6.5 and introduces legumes, it will it will lose its pioneering capability. In a tree situation with trees, it's just not a problem. But in most open farming situations, to me, it is one of those plants that are a great indicator of the depletion of organic matter in the soil. And because it is in its natural state or without the preparations on it, it isn't attractive to animals, and that's what it's designed for. So what grows up can go back into the soil to increase the organic matter in the soil. So really, it is a messenger that we need to get organic matter in the soil. One chap, he's down on the south coast somewhere. He was making compost as a saleable product, as an additional income to his property. And where they spread it on an area that was very heavy with couch, the couch immediately lost its pioneering capability, and they got a wonderful cover of all sorts of plants that they didn't have before. So I think it is responsive to overcoming the problem that it's trying to do.
Good. Hamish, the other... Well, getting on to the compost question, which George has, he says, when I make compost, which I have added minerals to it, like rock dust, calcium, etc., will these minerals be applied through the tea? In other words, can he sort of liquefy the compost and spread it out? So is that a possibility? Would he lose the effect of the minerals by liquefying the compost?
No.
John, do you want to go with that?
No, look, once the minerals have been through the bacteria and fungi, one, they're stabilised and they become fully plant available. So it changes its character altogether. It is not like a handful of agricultural lime, or it's far better to use burnt lime anyway. But it is stabilised by the bacteria and the fungi, and look, he'd probably get 10 or 15 times better effect or more availability than he would if he put it straight onto the ground. So my answer is yes, whatever he turns into good compost will make good compost tea.
And just to pick up on people like Elaine Ingham or in the biodynamic work Maria Tun, there's a general acceptance that a liquid compost is good for 5 to 6 months, where a solid compost is more likely to be good for 5 to 6 years. So, if you take 5 years, if you can develop a regime where you're making enough compost and every 5 years a paddock gets it, then that's ideal. But in the short term, you may well find that putting a liquid compost out gives you, you can get over more of the property quicker, but it won't have as much lasting effect.
I think as far as Elaine Ingham and some of the other researchers are concerned, they are looking at the immediate available increase in production. They are not looking at the introduction and the build-up of the mycorrhizae and everything else in the soil that is going to remain there unless they're killed out, you know, by submersion from floods or fungicides or something like that. So I think, you know, I agree with what they're saying. The measurable effect above the ground might only last for 6 months, but they are repopulating and really getting the soil going. So I think I'm a great believer in doing as much as you can when we're talking bacteria and fungi that multiply, that if we can get it happening over all of our place, it's far better than concentrating on small bits of it at a time.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's why really, if you can get the biodynamic soil activator out at least once a year and preferably twice,
yep,
then that's what's going to be the most effective way of achieving what John's talking about.
Now, Hamish, I think we've covered all of George's questions, have we?
I think so, yeah, unless someone thinks otherwise.
No, well, yes, it's...
Probably with the cooch, now he's not running cattle?
No, he's got no stock at all. He's got thousands of acres and cereals and maybe a legume or so in rotation.
Right.
And it's no sheep at all.
Probably with if he could do his mulching or slashing or whatever method he is using to get the cooch or to keep it down, if he was to time his work on the cooch to new moon, he would probably find that will definitely hold its regrowth back dramatically.
Okay. Worth a try.
With cooch. Yeah, just do the, you know, what if he slashes it or mulches it or even if you work it, if you can do it on new moon, it is much more effective at steadying its regeneration down.
Look, I'll say something, not because I think it's practical, but it's something to think about. These people that don't have just crops and no animals, if you can somehow create a rotation where some cattle are on the countryside in your rotation somewhere, it is highly beneficial. Just in a vineyard, which is not cropping, but the story still holds good. James Milton, you know, was doing his biodynamics, and Peter Proctor always used to say to him, look, you need compost and you need animals in your vineyard. And after about 10 years, James got around to making compost and putting that out. And he rang up Peter and said, why didn't you tell me to use compost? You know, it's just so effective. And then another 10 years later, he got himself some of those midget Herefords, I think, and put a few of those.
No, they were Devons, yeah.
Devons, were they? He put them in his vineyard and rang up Peter and said, why in the hell didn't you tell me to put cattle in my vineyard before? Because they've been so effective. And, you know, for vineyards, people don't think about, you know, animals in vineyards, but they can be very effective in stimulating the fertility in the soil and the life in the soil. And it's the same in sugar plantations. You know, the people who can actually get a cycle or a rotation of cattle, it has a huge effect. So I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but if you can find a way to get that animal, particularly cattle, influence onto your cropping country, I'm totally confident you'll see a benefit.
I think a way to do that is look at adjusting cattle for a few months of the year on, you know, do that in rotation. So you're getting an income from what the cattle are grazing without having to go to the expense of buying cattle.
Yeah. Well, I just like to add that, because a lot of people will say it's impractical for a lot of people, but it really is worth doing, you'll find. So if you can find a way to trial that and work with it, on top of the biodynamic preparations, I'm sure you'll see a benefit.
That's a good question. Now, getting on to the composting side of things, we saw what you did, Hamish, on that DVD. Now, John, what sort of products do you put into your compost, or what sort of products would you advocate people to put into compost, like on a larger scale? We saw the sort of a small scale where you can do things fairly ideally, but on a larger scale, what are some of the products that you'd put in or suggest people put in?
In my case, was the when I had the 6,000 citrus trees, all of the prunings went through a chipper and became the bottom 8 or 10 inches, sometimes a couple of foot, of the base of the heaps. And then in most cases, it was animal manure out of our yards, spoiled hay, loosened hay, or whatever sort of, in most cases, it would be spoiled loosened hay, layered in with the manure, clay from what we cleaned out of our earth dams, anything at all, the fish from the carp eradication scheme, the 200 metre heaps in most years, they would be getting, you know, $150, $200 of carp straight into the heap. Like anything like kangaroos or anything like that happened to run into an unmarked gum tree are terrific. Whatever you can get that you know, has been alive, the best way to regain everything that's gone into them is putting them through compost. But I, in most cases, my compost heap on making would probably be 9 foot tall and about 14 feet wide at the bottom and 200 metres long. Basalt dust I also included, but yeah, anything that well, I always say that, you know, if we eliminate the word waste from our vocabulary and change that word to potential, everything that has an organic base is potential fertility when we put it through our compost heap. So basically pasture or the chips, pasture toppings, spoiled hay, manure from the cattle yards, and the, you know, topped up with the kangaroos and the carp and everything else that I can get to put in there.
Good.
And can I just say, with compost, it one of the things that out of experience, start with a fairly modest compost heap and just learn to get the balance of protein, carbohydrate and moisture right before you start going into big ones, because as John said, you can use whatever you've got at hand, but make some, you know, modest ones first to get a feel for what's working and what isn't working, because basically there are two things that can go wrong. It can be too wet or too dry, and you know, if you to get all of that balanced right. If it's a smaller heap, you don't have so much to do to correct it if it's out of balance. Once you've got a feel for it, then make heaps the size of John's by all means.
I think probably, Hamish, the greatest thing that I've learned about making compost in larger quantities is putting it on a slight slope, level, but on a slight slope, so the watering. I just put a little bank at each end, and fill that little reservoir about a foot deep right along the compost heap. And I reckon I wouldn't even use 10% of the water that I did over the years trying to irrigate and keeping it wet from the outside. When you put it through, let it run through on the base, it transpires upwards, and you can regulate the moisture content of the heap more accurately with very, very little water.
That's great revision there, John. Hamish and John, I want to say ask two things about the composting, and both you can just chip in and answer these. When it comes to the preparations that farmers put into the compost heap, what are the preparations? How would they make them? And is it better for them initially, so that it doesn't become daunting to just buy them from you?
Initially, certainly, I'd be buying them, and they're the biodynamic compost preparations. You can also, like, I think John makes a fish emulsion using the preparations and puts that in.
I use that to put into the compost heap.
Yeah. So you can, if it's huge, if you're trying to make huge compost heaps, you can make what I call a sort of a starter compost that's a really good one, and then, you know, put that into a larger one, so to speak, so you're bringing that influence in. But normally you can buy the compost preparations and you just put them in little balls of old compost and stick them into the heap. It's not very complicated to do. And start with being a bit modest with it, get to know it, and then you can make big ones.
I think probably the other thing to add about the compost preparations, you can do it in a static heap. I only turn mine once during the whole process. If I was using that mechanical method of turning and working the compost continually, the cost would be so much more in labour, in fuel, than it is simply by inserting the compost preparations and leaving it as a static heap, that I think it is just so far in front that it is foolish to consider making compost without using the compost preparations.
John, yep. Do you monitor the temperature on the compost, and how do you monitor the temperature, especially if it's
well,
not that high?
Well, I've got silage, the big silage thermometers, which, it's about 18 inches long and fairly heavy, but you still, you know, need to be careful with them. And I insert that, and I believe that, well, I've not had any weeds germinate once I get up around that 59 degrees Celsius. I think once what I have had, Dr. Jeff Rigby's work, was that one lot got to... it got up around 71 or 72 degrees, and there was a marked decrease in both bacteria and fungi numbers. So I think that 59, 60 degrees, try not to go over that. And if you can get up that 59, 60 degrees, I don't know of any seed that is going to remain viable.
Good, good. All right.